focusing on the challenges facing the African Union, particularly relating to the flagship projects of Agenda 2063 and neocolonialism that continues to plague the continent. Stay with us and send your comments through our social media handle. African Union challenges. The African Union is a continental body consisting of the 55 member states that make up the countries of the African continent. It was officially launched in 2002 as a successor to the Organization of African Unity that was formed in 1963. Declaring the first summit open in July 9, 2002, the then South African President Thabo Mbeki stated that the inaugural African Union summit was a proud but challenging moment. The launch was met with great optimism.
We have convened at this stadium in Durban in the South African province of KwaZulu-Natal to make a pledge to the peoples of Africa and the world that we will honor the commitments we made as we agreed to establish the African Union. As a South African, I am proud that Africa is taking the giant step forward that she is taking today.
The African Union has since accomplished much to unlock Africa's potential and secure prosperity, but much more remains to be done. In over two decades since it was officially founded, the organization has amplified Africa's voice on the global stage and is breaking down the continent's trade barriers. But critics say the African Union needs to better deal with the conflicts and neocolonialism that continues to threaten the continent's prosperity, as well as to find a unified voice to tackle climate change. The African Union was established to hasten the process of integration on the continent while addressing multifaceted social, economic, and political problems. 22 years after its formation, experts believe the AU is yet to attain the envisaged aspiration.
I think the performance for the first 10-year time frame, where they had all the seven aspirations, was still below 60%, I would say, because we still have a lot of problems in Africa, and that is not helping the AU to be able to achieve the agenda as should be. But there are other issues as well that needs to be rectified. And one of them is the role of the Pan-African Parliament as a platform to echo the voice of the people of Africa. So, and the Pan-African Parliament is not well valued to play that role as supposed to, as been recognized in the protocol. So we need to address that, the role of Pan-African Parliament, and need to value what the work that the Pan-African Parliament can help to help the AU and all the members countries to achieve the Agenda 2063.
The January 2013 African Union Summit adopted Agenda 2063, The Africa We Want, as Africa's blueprint and master plan for sustainable development and economic growth of the continent. A leading Pan-Africanist, Paul Lumumba, elaborates on some of the salient points of Africa's Agenda 2063.
What brings me to the last segment of my conversation, Africa Agenda 2063. I remember on that day in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, Nkosazana and Lamini Zuma, the then chairman of the Organization of the African Union, writing and reading an imaginary letter to Osagie for Kwame Nkrumah. I will not remember the words exactly, but I'll remember it in substance. And in substance, he was saying, by the year 2063, we Africans, having recognized that we may have lost the last 50 years of our independence, will not lose the next 50 years of our independence. I'm adding a few things in order to make it relevant. But she was saying, in effect, the Osagie for in the year 2063, Africa will be different. There'll be an electric rail running from Addis Ababa in Ethiopia to Dakar in Senegal. In the year 2063, Africa will be feeding herself and the breadbasket of Africa will be Zimbabwe in Southern Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Africa will be making her own furniture, and we will do so in a sustainable manner with the equatorial forests of Congo being the source of our products. I will remember in those years to come, what you now see as the Sahara Desert will have been greened. Africa will be covered in forests. The Democratic Republic of Congo will become the equivalent of the Silicon Valley. There will be rare earth. Africa will use phones made by Africans. Africa will refine their own oil. Africa will use our own copper. Africa will have excess electricity. Africa will have the Inga Dam in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Africa will have built the Grand Renaissance Dam. And indeed, at that time, Sudan will not quarrel with Ethiopia, and Egypt will not quarrel with Ethiopia. They will be using these resources well. Africa will not be importing fish, tilapia, from China. The fish will be produced in Lake Victoria, Lake Tanganyika, Lake Tana, and all these other places. That was the reason of Africa Agenda 2063.
The conditions for implementation of the first decade of Agenda 2063 had not been favorable for the optimal achievement of the objectives set under the various programs. Observers point out that the implementation of Agenda 2063 has been unsatisfactory.
I would say the continent is on course to achieve, but the problem is that the pace, the momentum, is too low. So we're not moving as fast as we should to be able to achieve the agenda. But the work is being done. There's a lot of work being done. And on a national level, many countries, and some countries are doing so well, progressing well in terms of technological transformation. Some countries are really developing the sectors using technology. So there's a lot of work, but the work is going too slow. Because and that is part of also because of the problems Africa are also facing. There's access to electricity. Even if we want to move into the transformation, digital transformation, and making use of the technology, but if we don't address electricity, for example, in some areas of Africa, we still be lacking behind. So there's so much that needs to be done, and but that's why we need to be more aggressive. The organs need to be more aggressive, and we need to be work better with all the institutions.
African Union faces criticism for its inability to end prolonged conflicts. This is despite the AU's efforts in peacekeeping and conflict resolution. Moussa Faki Mohamed, chairperson of the African Union Commission, says the resurgence of military coups, pre- and post-election violence, humanitarian crises linked to war and effects of climate change are all very serious sources of concern for Africa. He notes that these challenges are tarnishing the signs of the emergence of a proud Africa. These tragedies have killed large numbers of African civilians and thrown thousands of people into dangerous situations and misery. According to World Bank projections, the African continent free trade area could double intra-African trade by 2035, increase foreign direct investment by 111% to 159%, and elevate GDP by 1.4% to 2.7%. Real income could rise by 7% to 9% by 2035, reducing the number of people living in extreme poverty to 45 million. Secretary General of African Continental Free Trade Area, Wamkela Mini, says ordinary Africans will immensely benefit from this free trade area.
The AFCFTA is not for governments. It's negotiated by governments, but it is for the private sector. And in particular, it is for small medium enterprises and young entrepreneurs. As you know, 450 million jobs are created in the small medium enterprises sector in Africa. This small medium enterprise sector in Africa is one of the largest drivers and motive forces of Africa's economic activity. And so it is absolutely critical that as we implement the AfCFTA, we do so in a way in which small, medium enterprises and young entrepreneurs will benefit. We have introduced what we call the Guided Trade Initiative, which is an initiative intended to assist countries who have ratified the AfCFTA and to assist small, medium enterprises to know how to trade under AfCFTA preferences and under the rules of the AfCFTA.
While initiatives such as the African Continental Free Trade Area are major milestones in Africa's integration and development, there is concern that some of the achievements will be compromised if the AU does not fund its own initiatives and agenda.
AU should be able to raise adequate funding to be able to deal with all those matters. Free trade is one area that is very important to, we should have been able to do more in that first 10 years because, but the problem with the funding is the contribution of member states is still a problem, is not adequate. And we still have to depend on external donors.
The Fourth Industrial Revolution, or 4IR, is the next phase in the digitalization of the manufacturing sector. The African Union is expected to lead African countries by investing in research development to drive innovation in various sectors. This goes together with promoting digital literacy and access to technology for all populations to enable tech inclusion in this digital age.
I don't know exactly what have been done at the level of AU, but I know in individual countries and some groups are really building up networks in Africa. I know there's a WOICC or something, I read it somewhere. So they really I think they are the ones who built the Eastern Africa submarine cable. And really made a big difference in the region in terms of connectivity. And I know that the telecom companies like MTN, also some private companies are really working towards that and to be able to transform Africa through digitalization. So, but on AU level, I'm not so sure how much has been done, I'm sure we need to do more. And but the transformation with technology, but we also, like I said earlier, we need to be able to deal with that electricity as well, access in remote areas as well. So the solar energy projects need to be done on a greater scale so that people can get access to electricity.
African Union challenges.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The Israeli genocidal war on Gaza has directly and indirectly affected Africa's economic, diplomatic, peace, and security landscape in many ways. Africans have taken part in massive rallies to express solidarity with Palestinians while condemning the Israeli genocidal regime.
The apartheid state of Israel's embassy is no longer welcomed in South Africa.
That we stand side by side with Hamas, with the Palestinian resistance, and we will fight side by side with them to ensure that they too realize their liberation in their lifetime.
The African Union is using its long-standing support for the liberation of Palestine to condemn the Israeli genocide on Palestinians in Gaza, a move that has certainly uplifted its relevance in multilateral spaces.
Some members of the African Union, primarily South Africa, you will recall, have taken the issue of the genocidal war in Gaza and the Israeli Zionist regime to the International Court of Justice at The Hague. You will recall that. So I think in that regard, this reflects the general sentiment of the African masses, the African people, and their solidarity with the just struggle of the Palestinian people, which has long been going for over 75 years, ever since the Nakba in 1948. As to whether the African Union has taken a stand, officially there is none. But as I said, many member states of the African Union do sympathize with this South African stance, have expressed their support in various ways.
The apartheid Israeli regime has tried to infiltrate the African Union on several occasions, but has failed. Instead, there is an increase in Palestine solidarity efforts across the length and breadth of the continent. The Israeli regime is pursuing a failed policy of disrupting Africa's support for Palestine.
Well, this has been ongoing. I think one is to reverse the African Union's recognition of the Palestinian cause. You recall that the Palestinian Authority, Palestine, has an observer status at the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And so this is, I believe, a worrisome concern for the Zionist regime, and it wants to reverse this or insert itself to neutralize the growing diplomatic recognition of the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian state, similar to what is ongoing at the United Nations. So that is one. The second is, of course, Israeli penetration in African affairs, in Africa's economies, Africa's political discussions. In the Congo region, for example, the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the ongoing conflict or war there that has been raging for almost 30 years now. Genocidal war is going there. Some estimate over 10 million people have died. What is the root cause of this genocidal war? It is a war of loot and plunder of Congo's resources.
Kenyan President William Ruto once demanded respect for African leaders after the U.S.-Africa summit in Washington. He said during summits between African leaders and individual countries, African representatives are often mistreated and treated like school kids by Western countries hosting these gatherings. The African Union has been criticized for allowing such summits to continue. However, observers say the ultimate decision on participation in these summits lies with individual countries.
One of the heads of states commented on a political discourse with different world leaders. And this is something up to the states themselves and up to the leaders of Africa to deal with on their own premise, on their own time, and basically the way they want to act upon it, because that's the sovereign right of the states. But the African Union has no authority on any of these actions. The African Union as an organization only has an authority on what happens between the organization and other parts of the world.
At least 13 foreign countries have a military presence in Africa. The US and its allies such as France, the UK, Germany, Italy and Belgium make up a large chunk of the countries with a military presence on the continent. These military installations are more to advance the interests of their own countries rather than contributing to Africa's development and security. On a positive note, some African countries such as Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger have been able to break off the chains of Western military influence. However, Western military presence is still a major challenge in Africa and is in fact seen as continuation of the chains of colonialism. The African Union is perceived by many Africans as having failed to ensure that Africa is able to guarantee its own security and thus remove the pretext of the presence of colonial forces.
The African Union has been remiss in its responsibility. It has been derelict in forcefully condemning such military basing inside Africa by external powers, especially former colonial rulers and imperialist powers. You are right. For example, take in our region, the Horn of Africa. I come from Eritrea. Right next door to Eritrea, to its southeast, right by the Bab el Mandeb, in a tiny city-state called Djibouti, there are numerous Western countries occupying the space there. The United States, UK, France, the former colonial master of Djibouti, Italy, Germany. The only non-Western country that has a presence there is, of course, China. But that, in a nutshell, symbolizes the occupation of Africa by foreign military powers. Now, the other one that is of great concern to Africa should be the AFRICOM, or Africa Command, the United States Africa Command. The United States has several military commands to occupy or to control the globe. There is a central command, for example, that's concerned with Western Asia, the Middle East area. There's the Pacific Command, and so on and so forth. So AFRICOM is part of that to control Africa. And the United States has, AFRICOM has military-to-military relationships with almost most of the African countries, except with the exception of Eritrea and perhaps Zimbabwe. Those are the two countries that do not have any relationship with Africa.
The African Union certainly faces worrying headwinds in the decades ahead. Many young people in Africa wanted a really united Africa where they can move freely while using a common currency, as in the case of Europe, and in line with the goal of a federalized Africa. The youth in Africa expect the AU to push for political integration.
The AU is already trying to get into political integration, and we have on the agenda of the summit annually, a report by His Excellency President Museveni, the President of Uganda, who is the champion for political integration in the African Union, presenting his findings and his efforts to try to reach political integration. On the other hand, of course, we have a lot of, strides in relation to the integration of Africa, with the CFTA on one side, with the Freedom of Movement Protocol on the other side, to make sure that this will happen step by step. This is where we want to achieve at the end, as you mentioned, the freedom of movement and maybe one currency. And we will be able to achieve that step by step, as we're trying to do right now, via different conventions that member states aspire through it, to achieve Agenda 2063, the Africa we want, and to achieve integrity and freedom.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
Let's recite the Quran.
وَإِذَا قَرَأْتَ الْقُرْآنَ جَعَلْنَا بَيْنَكَ وَبَيْنَ الَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْآخِرَةِ حِجَابًا مَسْتُورًا.
الْقُرْآنُ نُورٌ وَبَيَانٌ. الْقُرْآنُ هَدْيُ الْإِيمَانِ. الْقُرْآنُ مِسْكُ الْخِتَامِ.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل.
Assalamu alaikum, respected brothers and sisters from all over the world listening to IRB English Radio right now. Welcome to Let's Recite the Quranic Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International Schools Network. We are so glad to have Brother Ali Nasir, Hassan Nasrullah and Hussein Rahullah with us. Assalamu alaikum, brothers, everyone. How are you?
Alhamdulillah, sir.
Alhamdulillah. Great. And Hassan?
Alhamdulillah, sir.
And Hussein, how is it going?
Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah. So everyone is ready, energetic. So brothers and sisters, dear listeners, hope you are doing great. Let's get started. Today, we will be talking about Ayah 94 and 95. Surah Al-A'raf. On what page?
162.
Page 162, if you have your Quran with you, Ayah 94 and 95 of Surah Al-A'raf. We will be listening to the recitation and inshallah we'll continue our class. Ready everyone?
Yes, sir.
Let's
yes.
go.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
وما أرسلنا في قرية من نبي إلا أخذنا أهلها بالبأساء والضراء لعلهم يضرعون ثم بدلنا مكان السيئة الحسنة حتى عفوا وقالوا قد مس آباءنا الضراء والسراء فأخذناهم بغتة وهم لا يشعرون.
Nice recitation, mashallah. So Ayah 94 and Ayah 95. I will read it once, guys, okay? Then, inshallah, one of you will be reciting, then we'll work on tajweed points. All right?
Yep.
Yes. So,
let's see what Allah Almighty says in Ayah 94 and 95 of Surah Al-A'raf. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wama arsalna fi qaryatin min nabiyyin. إلا أخذنا أهلها بالبأساء والضراء لعلهم يضرعون. We did not send a prophet to any town without visiting its people with stress and distress so that they might entreat for Allah Almighty's forgiveness. The point is this. Let me ask you a question. Ali Nasir, do you think that we will never face troubles and problems and difficulties and challenges in life?
No.
It is impossible, yes?
Yeah.
So this life is full of challenges. Hassan, you agree?
Yes.
Okay. Hussein, can you name some of the challenges that people, humankind, might face in this life?
They can face many challenges.
The biggest one, what do you think?
In my opinion, the biggest challenge is that someone does zulm on him, what we...
So, if someone is being oppressed...
Oppressed, yes.
Yeah, so...
It's the biggest challenge.
Okay, great. So, this life is full of challenge, as Allah Almighty says. We did not send a prophet to any town without visiting its people with stress and distress. It means people are being... People are being tested, yeah? They face challenges, they face a lot of troubles. So, what? To strengthen their iman... لَعَلَّهُمْ يَضَّرَّعُونَ so that they get back to Allah Almighty. They should understand the reality. Alright?
Yes.
This is the meaning of this. They should understand the reality.
قَلْبٌ بِالْحَقِّ تَعَلَّقْ وَبِغَارِحِ رَاءَ تَأَلَّقْ يَبْكِي يَسْأَلُ خَالِقَهُ فَأَتَاهُ الْوَحْيُ فَأَشْرَقْ اِقْرَأْ
Let's recite the Quran.
Iqra. Bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq.
So, Hussein, can you read the first ayah? Wama arsalna fi qaryatin?
Yes. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَا فِي قَرْيَةٍ مِّن نَّبِيٍّ إِلَّا أَخَذْنَا أَهْلَهَا بِالْبَأْسَاءِ وَالضَّرَّاءِ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَضَّرَّعُونَ
أَحْسَنْتُ مَا شَاءَ اللَّهُ وَمَا Is the mat wajib Ali Nasir?
No.
So it is?
Jais.
Jais. You need to stretch it or no?
It's optional.
Optional.
Yeah.
You're allowed to ignore this.
Yes.
And fi qaryatin tin tanween plus meme.
Yes.
Huh? How do you read it?
Fi qaryatin
tim.
It's idgham. Emerged.
Idgham. Emerged them. And min nabiyyin. Min nabiyyin. Min nun sakin. Plus noon.
Idgham Mithlain.
Idgham Mithlain. Also called Idgham with Ghunnah.
Yes.
Min Nabiyyin. Yin illa. No changes, right?
Yeah, Idgha.
Illa akhazna ahlaha. So this mad are three mad up to now we have had. وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَا إِلَّا أَخَذْنَا أَهْلَهَا. Since the Hamza is in another word.
Yes.
Okay. بِالْبَأْسَاءِ, the mad, is that wajib?
Yes. Now it's wajib.
This is wajib. ضَرَّاءِ. Is the mad wajib?
Yes.
So we should stretch it for how many counts, Hassan?
Six
counts. Five counts. Six counts. So we should. بِالْبَأْسَاءِ وَالضَّرَّاءِ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَضَّرَّعُونَ. Make sure you pronounce the tashdeed properly. Next ayah. Ali Nasir, can you recite it? ثُمَّ بَدَّلْنَا مَكَانَ السَّيِّئَةِ الْحَسَنَةَ حَتَّى عَفَوُ.
Yes. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ثم بدلنا مكان السيئة الحسنة حتى أفوا وقالوا قد مس آباءنا الضراء والسراء فأخذناهم بغتة وهم لا يشعرون.
يشعرون. Alright, thank you. Let's fix these things. ثم Make sure you stretch the sound, yes?
Yeah.
Two counts.
مشدد.
Yeah. ثم the nasal sound.
Yes.
بدلنا مكان السيئة الحسنة حتى عفوا وقالوا قد. حسن, the echoing sound on dal, yes?
Yes.
قد
قلقلة.
Yeah, قلقلة, ضرور قلقلة. قد مس آباءنا, the mad is واجب. الضراء, mad واجب. والسراء, مد واجب. فأخذناهم هم بغتة. Ali Nasir did not apply the rule إخفاء of ميم. Yeah?
Yeah.
فأخذناهم هم. ميم ساكن plus با. ميم ساكن plus با. You should hide the sound of ميم. Yeah?
Yes.
أخذناهم بغتة. غين heavy sound. بغتة وهم لا يشعرون. So, that's it, brothers and sisters. Now, time to recite these two ayatain from Surah Al-A'raf. I will be reciting. Everyone is going to repeat. Make sure, inshallah, you join us in practice. Everyone, ready?
Yes.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
وما أرسلنا في قرية من نبي إلا أخذنا أهلها بالبأساء والضراء.
وما أرسلنا في قرية من نبي إلا أخذنا بالبأساء والضراء
إلا أخذنا أهلها بالبأساء والضراء لعلهم يضرعون.
إلا أخذنا أهلها بالبأساء والضراء لعلهم يضرعون.
ثم بدلنا مكان السيئة الحسنة حتى عفوا وقالوا
حتى عفوا وقالوا
وقالوا قد مس آباءنا الضراء والسراء فأخذناهم بغتة وهم لا يشعرون
وقالوا قد مس آباءنا الضراء والسراء فأخذناهم بغتة وهم لا يشعرون.
All right, let's pay attention to the ikhfa of me. فأخذناهم بغتة وهم لا يشعرون
فأخذناهم
بغتة وهم لا يشعرون. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
Ahsantum. Thank you so much. Allah bless you, brothers and sisters. Thanks for listening to IRB English Radio. That's it from us for today. See you in the next session. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi at-tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajhum.
Let's Recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be discussing the increasingly desperate measures being taken by the Zionist entity via its assets to counter the growing support for the Palestinian cause around the world. A new Zionist troll farm that was established last year is one such example. Latifa Abu Chakra has this report about the sinister tactics being deployed by the so-called Shirion Collective.
Shirion Collective is an ultra-Zionist troll farm dedicated to targeting pro-Palestine citizens for social harm, including embarrassment, loss of employment or earnings, or in some cases, threats and violence. It started in late 2023 and claimed to have members in US, Canada and the UK. It uses the technique known as doxing, meaning it publishes the personal details, including photographs and home addresses. It also offers a bounty for disclosure of useful information. In late 2023, there were indications that the collective was becoming active in Australia. In December 2023, a Sydney resident named Theo had a picture of his house and his address posted to a Facebook group. He had raised a Palestinian flag and placed a blackboard with messages critical of Israel in front of his home. Less than 2 weeks later, a jerry can with rags stuffed into it and a disposable lighter and large bolts were placed on the bonnet of his car with a message, "Enough, take down the flag, one chance." In February this year, the Shirion Collective launched an infiltration campaign of the pro-Palestine movement, promising that the Operation Global Insight to recruit infiltrators, individuals who can maintain cool, calm, and collected demeanors under triggering Jew hate and pressure, volunteers willing to wear kufiyas and walk in these demonstrations masked, individuals with Arabic-sounding names and Middle Eastern appearance may be uniquely positioned for deeper infiltration and will receive cash compensation for their vital role in our operation. Those signing up were promised you will be provided an hour-long basic training by one of our ex-Mossad team leads. There are indications that the announcement may have been simply intended to intimidate demonstrators, as implied by messages on its Telegram channel. "We won't need to do anything," one volunteer wrote. "They, supporters of Palestine, will 1. Tone down, 2. Police their own, 3. Maybe even beat up their own just because they think that those are one of us. And all accomplished by one tweet. Doesn't even cost a cent." There are other indications that the group is involved in psychological warfare, such as its claim to be developing a sophisticated AI tool to produce fake materials with which to attack pro-Palestine campaigners. The pro-Israel AI Maccabee has never been launched. Shirion voices or boosts Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian hate while celebrating death and destruction in Gaza and violence against their supporters in the West. It has repeatedly celebrated the deaths of Palestinians in Gaza, including Palestinian journalists and children. One question raised by this is who or what is behind the anonymous group, and to what ideas and ideologies are they attached?
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert and eminent scholarly critic of Israel, David Miller. David's a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul's AIM University, and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Today's guest contributor is the founder of Stop Zionist Hate, Abdullah Hassan. Abdullah's fearless activism has seen him doxxed by a fanatical pro-Israel group called the Canary Mission, and he's also been threatened by the Shirion Collective. Welcome to the show. Hassan, you run the very successful Stop Zionist Hate campaign. Just give us a flavour of what it does, will you?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was created in early November, and it was meant to sort of address the power imbalance that, you know, you see on X and Instagram. They're large, you know, well-funded organizations that are pro-Israeli that, you know, harass people for simply holding a Palestinian flag or saying Free Palestine. And, you know, as your, you know, co-host was saying, you know, they dox these individuals, they provide personal details, private information, such as their, you know, home address, their employers, and, you know, the goal is to make it uncomfortable for people to express views in favor of Palestine in the United States. And, you know, to counteract that, we are fighting back and doing the same thing. But the only difference is that we're actually exposing people who incite violence, who espouse extremely hateful things. You know, they say we've exposed doctors and lawyers who say flatten Gaza, kill every Gazan, kill every Palestinian, we should turn Gaza into a parking lot, etc. Whereas they harass people for simply, you know, holding a Palestinian flag, which is not, you know, anything violent or anything, you know, remotely threatening.
Yes, indeed. But David, I mean, Latifa's report gave us a glimpse, didn't it, just of how nasty and vindictive the Shirion Collective really is. I mean, what do you make of them offering bounties for information about Palestinians to expose Palestinian activists?
Well, I mean, this is the key contrast, and it's very interesting to hear Hassan talk there about Stop Zionist Hate and the massive contrast and distinction there is between its activities and the work of Syrian Collective, which, of course, is actually, in, you know, not only offering money and on people's heads, effectively, but also actually encouraging violence. And we saw the example in the film there of that Australian activist who was threatened and then he found outside his home a jerry can with petrol and the like. So that's what they're doing. And, of course, the other distinction is that these people are racists. Stop Zionist Hate is an anti-racist adventure. So we see a fundamental contrast between the strategies of the pro-Palestine movement and the Zionist movement, and that's the key thing to keep hold of.
No, indeed. Well, Abdullah, I mean, you were doxxed and then attacked by Syrian, weren't you? I mean, what was that? Just give us a flavour. What was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you know, when we targeted people, we didn't dox them. We were very, you know, nice to these people. I even, you know, received DMs from this lady that we exposed for saying something extremely hateful towards Palestinians. And, you know, I felt bad for her, so I decided to delete the post. But once, you know, my identity was exposed, you know, that, you know, niceness was not reciprocated in any way by these accounts. I mean, these accounts, you know, like the Syrian Collective, are completely ruthless. And they made up things. You know, they said I was wanted by the FBI, which I obviously wasn't. They said, you know, they put a bounty on my head. I've received, you know, countless death threats, etc. And, you know, the crazy thing is these, as your colleague was saying, there's ex-Mossad agents working in these organizations. These organizations are funded by, you know, Israeli interests. So this is not an internal battle. This is, you know, a foreign country harassing and exerting influence on U.S. politics. And that's what we're sort of exposing, and that's what's been exposed. You know, they've exposed themselves over the past few months, whereas Stop Zionist Hate is completely U.S.-based. We don't receive money from any foreign country or any foreign entity. And the irony is, you know, they're accusing us of, you know, being funded by Hamas and Qatar. You know, decent-sized accounts have said that, and it's not true at all. It's, they're sort of, you know, admitting what they themselves do. They're the ones that are funded by a foreign country. We don't receive donations anymore, but we used to receive donations only from the U.S., whereas this, our opposition is, you know, a foreign-controlled sort of political machine.
Yeah. No, indeed. David, I mean, Syrian's whole modus operandi seems to be based around intimidation, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's intimidation in their daily activities, the doxing of people, the threatening of people, and intimidation in their sort of strategic activities, where they say, you know, we're offering money for people to go in undercover in the Palestinian movement. It looks like that was an attempt just to intimidate, but it may well be that they are actually also doing that. But we don't know. I mean, it's difficult to tell. I mean, when we find out who the guy is, then you can tell a bit more about the operations. But it absolutely, this is about intimidation. It's about trying to stop anyone voicing pro-Palestine sentiments under threat of being doxxed or identified or having themselves reported to their employer.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Abdullah, I mean, how effective are Syrian's intimidatory tactics then, do you think?
To be honest, that particular account I don't think is that effective. It's mostly scare tactics. And, you know, the guy behind it, I mean, I don't want to, you know, go into details. You know, he's already been exposed on X, but he's not a professional guy. He's not, no. It doesn't seem like he's associated with Canary Mission. He wanted to take credit for doxing me and others, but I don't think it's super effective. And if you look at, you know, the engagement on X, a lot of their posts receive many less likes than, you know, comments going against them. So they get ratioed. You know, on X it's called a ratio when you comment on a post and get more likes than the original post. So just based on that, you see that they're not very popular on X with any audience, you know, with the U.S. audience, with the Middle East audience, with even people who are neutral on the topic. They see that, you know, their tactics involve harassment and inciting violence. And as you said, they're very, you know, sneaky with their tactics. They want to hire people with a Middle Eastern name to go into these pro-Palestine rallies and to sort of cause chaos and make it look like the pro-Palestine protests in the U.S., which have been overwhelmingly peaceful, overwhelmingly diverse. They want to make it look like it's just these Muslim extremists going on the streets and causing violence, which is not the case at all.
No, indeed. There's a lot there that, like you say, they're cutting through. But David, I mean, Syrians' entire focus is on spewing Islamophobic and, anti-Palestinian racism, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, all of their activities are pretty vile, but it's kind of all of a piece with the rest of the output of the broad Zionist movement. I don't just mean the organisations, but also the individuals, many of which have been exposed by Stop Zionist Hate. You know, the kind of vitriolic, kill them all, even the children, rape all the women. It's kind of comments that you get from across the whole range of Zionist public sphere, if you like. I mean, that's something which I think is new to many, many people. And it's not just that they see the genocide in Gaza and are repulsed by it, ordinary people, but they also see these Zionists who are celebrating the very thing that the whole world is aghast at. And I think that's the interesting thing is that, in terms of their success, is that they turn people off at a much, much faster rate than the traction they get for the kind of posts that they put out. So that's an indication that, of course, as we know, they are failing. They've lost the battle for public opinion all over the world. And, of course, in Palestine itself, they're losing the battle, the military battle against the resistance.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to thank our guest, Abdullah Hassan, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Day 288 of U.S. Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. Israeli regime continues its indiscriminate bombings of the Palestinian territory, killing more civilians, mostly women and children. Iran condemns Israel's attacks on education facilities in the Gaza Strip as criminal acts. And Cyprus observes the anniversary of an operation by the Turkish military, which led to the split of the Mediterranean island into Turkish and Greek-ruled parts. And welcome from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, it is day 288 of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza, and the Tel Aviv regime continues its unrelenting air and artillery strikes against the blockaded territory. In one of the strikes, at least three more Palestinians were killed, and several injured in Israeli bombing of a Palestinian home in the Al-Baraj refugee camp in central Gaza.